Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ursula Matulonis to review what's new and exciting in the field, and she began by discussing one of the most important papers in all of oncology in the past year, the GOG-218 study of bevacizumab in patients who were post-op from primary debulking surgery.
So this was a trial that was initiated a few years ago and involved three arms, and was also an important trial because it was really the first time that a targeted therapy has been added to the backbone of carboplatin and paclitaxel. So these were patients grouped into three groups. Group one were basically patients who just received carboplatin and paclitaxel intravenously. Paclitaxel was a dose of 175 milligrams per meter squared, and carboplatin AUC of 6. So that was the chemotherapy backbone for all three groups. And also, by the way, all the patients were operated on. So there weren't patients who had stage 4 disease or patients who were clearly not surgical candidates up front. So all patients underwent upfront attempted debulking surgery, were staged, and then placed on this trial. And there were about 1,800 patients total onto the trial. So the first group, as I mentioned, carboplatin/paclitaxel, period. The second group received carboplatin paclitaxel plus bevacizumab. And bevacizumab, the bev, was given at 15 milligrams per kilo IV starting on cycle 2. And the reason it was started on cycle 2 was really to help prevent any kind of wound complications or postoperative complications that could occur with bev. The third group was given carboplatin and paclitaxel plus bev during chemotherapy cycles 2 through 6, and then bev maintenance for a year. And all the patients were randomized blindly, so patients did not know if they were getting a placebo along with their infusion of chemotherapy. And then even if you're on arm one, you came in for every 3 weeks for the next year post-chemotherapy. So the results, the bottom line is, when comparing arm one to arm two, there were no differences in PFS and overall survival. But when you compared arm one to arm three, so just carboplatin paclitaxel versus carboplatin paclitaxel plus bev given during chemotherapy and as maintenance, there was an improvement in progression-free survival of just around 4 months. And 4 months was the goal of the study, to allow it to be a significant trial from a statistics standpoint. So what we saw was an improvement of PFS from 10 months overall for all groups to 14 months. And the other issues, overall survival was looked at, and there was no difference in overall survival when you compare groups 1, 2, and 3.
Now, I guess it's a little premature, though, to be looking at survival at this point.
It is, and I think this is a trial that we're going to have to sort of watch over time, let the data mature. I think the toxicity data is of interest, but I think the outcome data will have to be watched over time. Does that PFS change? Is there overall survival that's observed? But you're right. And I think the question is going to be whether or not there'll be an approval based upon the results presented at ASCO, and I'm not so sure about that.
You know, we see this in oncology so often, particularly with these novel agents, you know, where you might have a modest improvement in progression-free survival. We've seen that in bevacizumab and other tumors.
Correct.
Without overall survival. People try to figure out what it means, but the discussion on that paper by Dr. Eisenhower really was amazing. I don't know if you can explain it to me. I mean, I think I understood about half of it, but the one thing that she said, she was showing these curves and all, that I was trying to figure out was this idea that maybe a progression-free survival advantage of 4 months could translate into actually an absolute overall survival advantage of much longer. She put up theoretically, you know, 15 months, who knows, it might be zero. How does that happen?
It's watching patients over time. You know, it's certainly been seen in breast cancer studies where you just have to wait for some time to see whether or not you change the biology of this tumor. I think it's interesting that if you think about the other randomized trials that have been done in advanced ovarian cancer, you know, typically you'll see more robust changes in PFS. So for example, just simply changing Q3 week paclitaxel to weekly paclitaxel, and granted that was a trial that included patients with stage 2 cancer too, but they saw, as a Japanese study published in Lancet, they saw a 10-month improvement in PFS. when paclitaxel was added to platinum, there was about a 6 or 8 months change in PFS, but that translated into a year overall survival benefit. So I think we're going to have to watch this. These are not traditional cytotoxics that are being added. It's a targeted therapy. The question is, do targeted therapies kill more cancer cells, or is there more of a cytostatic effect, meaning you're going to just delay the progression of the cancer and not necessarily kill more cancer cells adequately?
Although also another thing about this study was, in a sense, I'm not sure I've seen another study, maybe there is, where you had two different durations of bevacizumab. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that that was the primary point, but the bottom line was there was more benefit when they gave it longer. What about the issue of duration? I mean, not that, you know, there may be economic issues or toxicity, but just theoretically from an efficacy point of view. I mean, are there discussions about longer duration, Bev, for example?
Well, sure, there are discussions, but I think at this point, it's not clear that longer is going to be better. Could shorter be better? And how exactly is bevacizumab working here? Is it just like giving, you know, 12 months of paclitaxel post-chemotherapy, where there you actually saw a little bit more of a robust PFS change, but there was no overall survival differences? You know, should bevacizumab be continued indefinitely? And I think the important question is, and this was certainly discussed at the ASCO meeting, was, are there certain subsets of ovarian cancer that are going to benefit from the use of bevacizumab than others? I mean, at this point, and I don't believe this is true in any of the cancers that are treated using Bev, that there's a predictive biomarker that can help a clinician make a decision, oh, I should use Bev in this patient or I should not, either from an efficacy standpoint or even a toxicity standpoint, to help us make these decisions. And I think these are huge decisions as our, you know, budget shrink down and the cost of healthcare continues to increase. We have to have a responsibility and take a responsibility for providing the most optimally beneficial care for patients, but thinking about the cost of therapy as well.
And I think actually in the discussion, Dr. Eisenhower brought up that issue, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out, you know, kind of what you're going to get for the money, so to speak. You mentioned side effects. What was your take on that? The one thing that I was really curious to see in that study was bowel perforation. What did they see, and how do you put the whole story together with bowel perforation and Bev and ovarian cancer right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was a participant on one of the two trials that used Bev for recurrent ovarian cancer. So one was done by the GOG, and that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology a few years ago. And in the same issue was another trial. Steve Canister was the first author from our group. And in our trial, we had patients who had platinum-resistant cancer. So all patients were platinum-resistant, meaning that they had cancer growth within 6 months of receipt of platinum. And they either had to have progression of cancer on topotecan or on liposomal doxorubicin, or within just 3 months of receipt of this. So these were patients who really had, would be described as difficult to treat cancer. Interestingly, the response rates were pretty good. Response rate was around 18%, but we did see 11% risk of GI perforations. And the patients who experienced GI perforations were really the patients who were the most heavily pretreated. They all had peritoneal carcinomatosis, or cancer that was around the bowel. But that wasn't necessarily a predictor of future perforation, but it was really the amount of treatment. And I think a lot of us who use Bev in patients with recurrent cancer are very sensitive to the level of pretreatment patients have undergone. So the more chemotherapy, the more sick they are. Combining it with a drug like paclitaxel, you know, paclitaxel by itself can cause a GI perforation. So, you know, chemotherapy can do this. So once you start combining Bev with chemotherapy in patients with platinum-resistant disease who have been heavily pretreated, that risk of perforation is likely to go up. And I also would screen out patients who have any evidence of a partial SBO, any patients who have difficulty with eating, constipation that you think is secondary to cancer. I really avoid using Bev in those patients. But with regard to GOG-218 and the upfront treatment, the GI perforate was as expected. That has been seen in colon cancer. And that rate was just below 3%. So it was 2.8%. And it was equal in both arms 2 and 3. So both arms that received bevacizumab. And in the first arm, arm 1, just getting carboplatin, the rate was 1.2%. So it essentially doubles, a little bit more than doubles, when using bevacizumab. And I think patients with previous bowel surgery, so a bowel resection, have to be careful with. And I've certainly seen bowel perforations that have occurred in patients with newly diagnosed cancer who get bevacizumab. So it definitely does happen.
I guess another thing about that study was interesting was they didn't report an increase in arterial venous events. And I've been trying to figure that out in general about Bev across all these different tumor types. Really kind of tricky. What's your take about that?
You're absolutely correct. There was no differences in arterial events or venous events. And I think that probably speaks to potentially a healthy population that are placed on the clinical trials. And the fact that ovarian cancer, there's certainly going to be patients who are more prone to developing venous complications just simply being post-surgical and having an advanced ovarian cancer, peritoneal or tubal cancer.
So, of course, everybody wants to know what's the bottom line in terms of non-protocol therapy and just sort of putting aside regulatory and cost and these kinds of issues. How do you see the risk-benefit profile playing out of this intervention right now, and are you offering it to your patients?
Mm-hmm. So I am, and our group is discussing the results with patients. So patients who are newly diagnosed and patients who also are about to complete their therapy and whether or not they should go on maintenance bevacizumab for a year. And I think there are going to be certain patients where there'll be right off the bat contraindications. So patients with poorly controlled hypertension, you know, the grade 3 toxicities or the grade 2 higher hypertension, that was at least tripled when you added bevacizumab to both maintenance as well as to the chemotherapy. So if somebody is not going to follow their blood pressure, if you don't think they're going to be able to manage that at home and let you know if they're having headaches or they're having symptoms of high blood pressure, that's a contraindication. Anybody who has a wound complication, an open wound, I think the final data will decide whether or not patients who undergo a bowel resection, if those patients are at more risk for developing a bowel perforation at the reanastomosis site. But certainly I would caution patients who have had a bowel resection that they're probably going to be at higher risk for developing a perforation at that site. And I think patients whom are receiving intraperitoneal chemotherapy, in fact, I just had a discussion with a patient today who had finished her 6 cycles of intraperitoneal platinum, and the decision is whether or not to go on maintenance bevacizumab. There's no data using Bev with IP chemotherapy or any other regimen besides intravenous carboplatin and paclitaxel. And I think patients in whom you really think they have a chance of survival, so patients who have stage 3A cancer, certainly any patient with a stage 2 cancer, they weren't even allowed on this trial, but somebody where you think they have a true possibility of a solid cure, because the bevacizumab has not changed survival. It's changing just how long the cancer stays away for.
I was going to ask you about intraperitoneal therapy in terms of right now, what kind of patient situations are you offering it? For example, this patient you just mentioned, and do you have any way to gauge the benefits sort of indirectly of intraperitoneal therapy if you had to choose versus carboplatin Bev?
Right. Well, any patient whom is healthy, in almost regardless of age, who has an optimal cytoreduction, meaning that they have less than a centimeter remaining at the completion of surgery, we consider intraperitoneal chemotherapy using the 172 regimen. There's a current GOG trial going on right now, 252, that is asking a number of different questions. So if certainly the patients who are optimally cytoreduced, whom are interested in intraperitoneal chemotherapy, that's an excellent study because it really asks the question of pure IV chemotherapy versus intraperitoneal cisplatinum and versus also intraperitoneal carboplatin. So it'll be a very interesting study to see the results of. But I think off clinical trial, the doses of intraperitoneal cisplatinum, you know, theoretically, according to 172, should be 100 milligrams per meter squared. But I think there's increasing data that in somebody whom you are worried about from a count standpoint or renal standpoint or just unable to tolerate that higher dose of cis, you could potentially start at 75 milligrams per meter squared. So I think there's some flexibility in the dosing of the cisplatinum IP to make it a more tolerable regimen. It's definitely more an intensive regimen, both for the patient as well as for the staff, and also use of resources. We admit patients to the hospital. We give them IV fluids as an outpatient. Once they've completed day one and day two of the chemotherapy, all patients get growth factor support, Neupogen specifically. So it takes a coordination of the medical team as well as the patient agreeing to do all these extra trypsin and medication injections, etc.
What would you say are the most clinically relevant complications that you see? And you mentioned hydration, and Bob Morgan mentioned that in an interview that he felt that, you know, he tried to be extremely aggressive about hydration and felt that that ameliorated some of the problems. What are your thoughts about that?
So I think the complications that were initially written about in the New England Journal article a few years ago really pointed to almost across the board all grade 3-4 toxicities being higher in the IP arm than the solely IV arm, and that would include infections, drop in blood counts, nausea, vomiting, kidney dysfunction, etc. But I think there are a lot of things that we can do to obviate and to really attenuate those side effects by the use of growth factors. There are some terrific antiemetics that can be used up front so patients don't experience the nausea, vomiting that they could get with intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And I agree with Bob that the hydration is important, that we can't expect patients to drink as much as possible. And I'm always somewhat surprised when patients come in for that day four hydration into our clinic over the weekend that their sodiums have dropped to 130, their sodiums are up to 129, and they tell you, yeah, you know, I've been drinking as much as I possibly can. So you know that the hydration is vital in giving them a little bit of normal saline, or not such a little bit. We usually give up to 2 liters over the weekend before they come in for day eight a few days later. So I think a lot of the toxicities can be ameliorated. And you'll know after one or two cycles whether or not patients are able to handle this, whether or not their creatinines change, if their sodiums drop, and what other complications could occur that might lead you to say, okay, let's make that switch from IP back over to IV, carbotaclitaxel.
So again, I want to get back to the GOG-218 study of Bev and try to tease out a little bit more about how you see this study and the potential benefit of Bev in this setting. I know it's kind of hard to be really specific in terms of what you might do, but maybe I can put it another way and ask you, do you see that the benefits that have been presented here are clinically useful, borderline, and significant? Any kind of flavor in terms of how you see this?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that certainly there's a benefit. The trial was written looking for a 4-month change, and that's exactly what happened. So it does meet significance. I think that when this trial was designed a few years ago, we weren't in the same healthcare debacle mess that we are right now, where I think drugs are going to be more scrutinized before approval for, you know, proof of benefit, but then also cost. So I think it's a tricky situation. So I can tell you that for the patients who I think are eligible to receive bevacizumab, so those patients who have high-grade serous cancer, where there's disease left behind, you know that those patients are going to have roughly an 80% risk of the cancer coming back. So in those patients, I'm definitely talking to them about bevacizumab and adding it during chemotherapy and as maintenance. And then, of course, checking with their insurance company to see whether or not their insurance company will actually cover the use of bevacizumab. I think it'll be interesting to see how future clinical trials are designed. For example, the upfront intraperitoneal chemotherapy study run by the GOG, all arms have bevacizumab. The other trial that we're waiting for results on is ICON-7, which is the European trial that also is adding bevacizumab, but it's adding a less dose of the bevacizumab. I believe it's 7.5 milligrams per kilo. So that'll be another confirmatory study to see whether or not they show any benefit to Bev. So I do think that it's of interest. We know it's a drug that works in women with recurrent ovarian cancer. There's no doubt about that. We do use it in recurrent disease. I use it. And I think you just have to understand the risks of the drug that we see. The risks are different in the recurrent setting than they are in the upfront setting in terms of the perforations, etc. But picking the right patient has to be thought of very carefully.
Now, when you use it in the recurrent setting, when do you usually use it? And do you use it with or without chemo?
I tend to use it in patients who clearly have manifested that they have chemotherapy-resistant cancer, meaning that they get platinum paclitaxel, maybe they recur within 6 months, maybe they recur after 6 months, but eventually they become more platinum-resistant they perhaps get topodoxal clinical trial, and their cancer progresses through that quickly. So then you know that picking another chemotherapy drug will probably have less usefulness. And that's when I tend to use Bev. Again, you know, ideally it's in patients who are compliant or going to check their blood pressures, maybe have nodal recurrence by themselves, you know, just a few periaortic nodes or pelvic lymph nodes who do not have diffuse peritoneal disease. Those to me are the ideal patients to use bevacizumab with in recurrent setting.
And it sounds like you're talking about monotherapy. Have you seen patients actually have clinically useful responses?
Mm-hmm. To monotherapy, yes. And again, it's those patients who have smaller amounts of disease, maybe minor symptoms or no symptoms, and the Bev can really, you know, sometimes shrink things a little bit, but really put a cap on the growth. And it's a drug that patients can stay on for a while, as long as you're following them. Sometimes I certainly will add a drug such as oral cyclophosphamide, like the California group did, published in the JCO a couple of years ago. And certainly if you needed to add chemotherapy, but I think the risks of Bev go up a little bit using weekly paclitaxel.
Have you had patients, I've heard about this sort of anti-aesthetic effect in some patients where, you know, I know people say that sometimes you get really good control of ascites and they're not really sure, is it an anti-tumor effect or sort of a VEGF vascular effect? Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. And in some of your first original papers of Bev in ovarian cancer were used in patients who had large volume ascites, and you saw this dramatic decrease in ascites. And I think our patient populations have changed over time where we now don't really see patients with large volume ascites. That just doesn't seem to happen as much. Just like you don't really see hypercalcemia in patients with breast cancer as much anymore, that the tone of the disease, the biology of the disease has changed. And I think that's probably partly observed because of the increased use of bevacizumab. But certainly it can control ascites. People say it dries up. I'm not so sure it dries up, but it definitely becomes less of a problem if the cancer, again, is biologically sensitive to Bev, because we know that VEGF drives cancer growth, that drives ascites formation. So it makes sense that Bev would work in that situation.
Any other ovarian cancer data sets that have come out in the last year that are important for oncologists to know about?
The one trial that really struck me was the Canadian study looking at olaparib in patients with either BRCA mutation carriers who had ovarian cancer or breast cancer or triple negative breast cancer. It was a great study, and I think it's going to yield a lot of information because they essentially had four groups of patients. They had patients with recurrent ovary mutation carriers, either BRCA1 or 2 carriers. Then they had non-mutation carriers. They had breast cancer patients who had triple negative cancer with or without a mutation. And what really struck me is that olaparib, which is an oral PARP inhibitor that's been reported in the New England Journal a few months ago, really has dramatic effects in patients with recurrent ovarian cancer who both are mutation carriers. But the other part of that trial that really opens up the field of PARP inhibitors for ovarian cancer, that it had over 20% response rate in patients who were non-carriers as well. Those patients who have high-grade serous cancer, where you know up to 60% of those patients have some alteration in BRCA1 or 2. Either they have a somatic mutation, they have hypermethylation of it, or something else in the DNA repair pathway. But those patients also experienced response rates. And in all those patients, in all those four groups, patients underwent biopsies prior to undergoing therapy at 2 months. And then when they progressed, they had a tumor biopsy at that point. So that kind of biopsy data is going to yield so much information on how these drugs work, what are the resistance mechanisms of PARP inhibitors. And I agree with all the discussants at that wonderful PARP inhibitor discussion that these are drugs that are going to have an impact in ovarian cancer.
I actually was able to interview Andy Tutt at ASCO, who's done a lot of work on olaparib and breast cancer. But now this paper by Karen Gelman, as you said, demonstrated responses in patients with ovarian cancer without BRCA germline mutations. Has this been reported or even looked at before?
Yes, this was the first study that really showed objective evidence that patients who do not harbor a mutation, a germline mutation, could respond to a PARP inhibitor as a monotherapy.
You know, we don't, in oncology, are not, unfortunately, we're not in a situation that often where you see agents where you can only get them on trials and you're seeing responses and people are telling you, I've got this patient and they responded. You know, in breast cancer, for example, you have T-DM1, the anti-HER2 agent that everybody's all excited about, but you can't get. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder about, you know, seeing these data on olaparib. I mean, before I was thinking about more if you have a patient with a BRCA tumor. Now, based on what you're saying, maybe other patients, how do you deal with patients who come in saying, you know, I've seen this on the internet, can I get it?
It's really difficult. And I see those patients all the time. I saw somebody just yesterday. And you just have to know where the clinical trials are open. And we all, each our individual centers, have certain studies that are open. For example, we have open a BSI 201 study. We have open a phase one of ABT 888 plus irinotecan. But the NCI has an open trial of carboplatin plus olaparib. So for a motivated patient, we can get them on a trial. But you're absolutely correct. It's very frustrating to have a potentially life-prolonging drug not available to patients. And again, it's disheartening to me to have a patient with a BRCA mutation who you know is clearly going to have benefit from a PARP inhibitor not being able to get that drug. That's really hard, and it's really hard for patients to not be able to get that drug.
Now, you mentioned BSI 201. Of course, we saw exciting data on that in breast cancer at ASCO 2009. Have we had any data on that in ovarian cancer at all, either alone or with chemo?
So we're currently doing that trial. Mike Beer is the overall PI. That's carboplatin plus gemcitabine plus BSI 201 in patients with platinum-resistant or platinum-sensitive recurrent cancer. But no, that's not been reported on. But we're in the process of doing that study right now.
Fascinating. I guess, you know, the carbo-gem combination kind of works a little bit better in ovarian cancer than in breast cancer. People are like, you know, we don't usually use that too much. Just parenthetically, do you ever use GEM up front instead of paclitaxel? You know, just as I look out and I look at the, you know, there was another paper reported at ASCO, and you see pretty different toxicity profiles, and yet I get the feeling that people don't really use it that much.
Well, at ASCO, the last session in the GYN oral session was a presentation from a group in Arizona who compared carboplatin paclitaxel versus carbo-GEM up front. And they used paclitaxel maintenance as well. But the bottom line was that there was no difference between carbo-gem versus carboplatin paclitaxel. We also saw that in GOG 182 that Bookman et al. Published a couple of years ago in the JCO. And also, there was not a big difference. So I think it allows you some flexibility. So if a patient, for example, either develops a significant paclitaxel reaction, or she says to you, look, I don't want to lose my hair. I still think carboplatin paclitaxel remains the standard. However, you've got alternatives, and I think carbo-gem is certainly one that could be used up front as well.
Why don't we go through your cases? They look really interesting. How about your first one?
Okay, so the first case is a patient of mine who was operated on, although she had a pleural effusion, which was cytologically proven to be malignant. She went through debulking surgery. She's a young lady in her early 50s, and she was found to have, interestingly, a grade 1 serous cancer and received intravenous carboplatin and paclitaxel up front. She started that around February, and it was actually delayed by about a week because she had a wound infection that we were giving antibiotics to. And she developed a life-threatening anaphylactic reaction to paclitaxel. So basically 10 minutes into the paclitaxel, she went out. And I responded to the co. We actually gave her epi, and she came back. We discussed the pros and cons, and she really wanted to get paclitaxel. So I pulled our allergists in. We desensitized her in the intensive care unit, and she did pretty well. So she went on to receive 3 cycles of intravenous paclitaxel and carboplatin.
Incidentally, have you ever used nab-paclitaxel?
You know, not up front, no, but certainly in the recurrent setting. But there's not great data that that can be safely used after a paclitaxel allergy. I've seen folks have used it, but just a little bit of caution that it's not necessarily 100% safe, but you could contemplate using it. And her CA125, when she started, was in the 180 range, and it really stayed very stable after 3 cycles. So I rescanned her, She had the persistence of her pleural effusion, and she had peritoneal disease with perhaps one implant around her liver being slightly larger. So the question was, you know, what to do in this situation? She's a patient who clearly has the emergence of platinum-resistant cancer. It's not necessarily growing, but she has cancer that's not biologically melting like it typically does with upfront chemotherapy. So we talked about potentially clinical trial, although it would be a hard one to make that switch from a platinum regimen to a clinical trial. We talked about switching to another platinum doublet to see whether or not there's any difference there. Would one add bevacizumab to this point, switch to Doxil? So the bottom line is I made the decision with her to switch from carbopaclitaxel to carbogem. And she's had one cycle of that already, and she's dropped her marker slightly from about 180 down to 150. So after two cycles of that, I will rescan her. But she's somebody who I would consider genotyping. So we're actually genotyping all of our newly diagnosed ovarian cancer patients. And because she has a low-grade serous cancer, where I'm going to be looking for RAF mutations to see whether or not she can go on a RAF inhibitor or a MEK inhibitor, because low-grade serous cancers of the ovary theoretically have an up to 30 to 40% chance of having a BRAF mutation.
And have useful responses been seen with anti-RAF and MEK agents?
So those trials are being done. There's GOG-239 that is using an AstraZeneca MEK inhibitor. There are trials that are ongoing looking at all comers with that same drug, but specifically with BRAF mutations. There's a Plexicon drug, but that has not been, to my knowledge, used in patients with ovarian cancers who have BRAF mutations.
Now, how is this patient tolerating the carbogem, and what's going on with her hair, incidentally?
Well, she did lose her hair with the paclitaxel completely. She just started the carbogem, did beautifully with it, has had no problems. And I'm going to see her this week, and I think her hair is starting to grow back a little bit.
What do you see in terms of myelosuppression with the carbogem?
She actually flew through it just fine. I used carboplatin AUC of 6 and gem 1,000, so a little bit higher than the recurrent regimen, but I still think because she's newly diagnosed that the AUC should be 6 and not 5. So she's doing so far very well. We'll see what the cancer's doing after another cycle.
How about your 60-year-old lady?
So the other patient is a 60-year-old woman who was diagnosed with a high-grade serous cancer, underwent optimal cytoreduction, received intravenous carboplatinum and paclitaxel, and then went through her chemotherapy just fine, normalized her CA-125, and then 3 months later had a marker that went from 10 to 20. She was nervous about that, so the marker was repeated another month. So now 4 months after completion of chemotherapy, marker goes up, and she has a CAT scan that shows some low-volume cancer, trace ascites, a few peritoneal implants, but nothing that is causing any kind of side effects. And it's interesting, this is the kind of patient that we're thinking about more, that she's not symptomatic from her cancer. You don't know at what point she will become symptomatic from her cancer. This was a presentation at ASCO last year about the utility of the CA-125 and whether or not it makes sense to treat patients earlier rather than later.
I mean, you came away from that thing last year wondering theoretically whether you ought to even be drawn to CA-125, but I think everybody still is.
I think everybody still is. And I think you're right. It'll be interesting to see in those patients, because they're going to be patients who solely have an elevation of their CA-125, and it may not even be outside the upper limits of normal. It may not, maybe 10 to 15 or 10 to 20. And everybody gets very upset when that happens. And it's a difficult conversation, especially if patients have a negative CT scan, physical exam, etc. What do you do in that situation? But in this patient, there's some small amount of disease. So there's something to prove that, yes, she's got cancer. I think in the absence of physical exam findings or evidence of a CT, when you only have an isolated CA-125 recurrence, we probably shouldn't be treating those patients. They should probably be put on a clinical trial. If they're worried because of their number going up, you can try an aromatase inhibitor or tamoxifen. But I think those patients probably don't benefit from the use of aggressive cytotoxic chemotherapy.
Have you seen significant drops or even objective responses with endocrine therapy in ovarian cancer?
You know, it's interesting that ovarian cancer has a very high level expression of ER and or PR on it. And the hormonal therapies just don't work that impressively well like they do in breast cancer. But I think for a patient who has a very slow rise in her CA125, I have seen, I wouldn't say objective responses on CT, but I have seen changes in direction of the CA125 starting to go down a little bit. And objective response rate with hormonal therapy is quite low. It's below 10%. So they're not particularly robust drugs in ovarian cancer.
You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of what you see in prostate cancer sometimes with PSA-only disease. And there, you know, one of the things people are starting to talk about is looking at novel non-toxic agents, you know, and those patients are asymptomatic. Any studies or agents you might consider her for or that she might be eligible for of new agents?
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of interesting types of agents that are in clinical trials now or about to be in clinical trials now. We've talked about PARP inhibitors already. There are a number of anti-angiogenic drugs, bevacizumab, obviously an antibody to VEGF, but there are drugs that bind to the intracellular component of the VEGF receptor too, such as sunitinib, cediranib. We're testing a drug called ENMD-2076, which is a combined VEGF receptor 2 inhibitor and an Aurora A kinase inhibitor. They're pure Aurora kinase inhibitors. We'll be seeing the start of drugs that interfere with the PI3 kinase signaling pathway, whether they're AKT inhibitors or PI3 kinase inhibitors. The question is, are they going to have efficacy? And I don't know at this point what we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think I'm sitting here like most clinicians going, you know, I wonder whether any of these are actually ever going to be useful, but it sure is interesting to hear about. One I heard about recently that sounds pretty interesting is farletuzumab, mm-hmm. a folate receptor alpha inhibitor. Could you tell me what that is?
So that's exactly what that is. It's an antibody to the folic acid receptor. That was presented at ASCO, the data on single agent as well as in combination with chemotherapy was presented. Single agent responses were so-so, but when it was combined with chemotherapy, the lengths of progression-free intervals were compared to the prior progression-free intervals, and in many cases, it was longer. So there was some interesting information, and we do know that there's lots of the folic acid receptor present on ovarian cancer. It's also present in endometrial cancer as well. So I think these are going to be an important class of drugs. It may not work by itself, but perhaps with chemotherapy, so with a platinum-based regimen, with liposomal doxorubicin, there are other types of folic acid receptor inhibitors that are being combined with liposomal doxorubicin. So I think it's an area of interest, and we'll have to see what the clinical trials bear out.
What do we know about the mechanism of action of this agent?
Well, it's hard to know how it's acting specifically, and I think that's probably why the single agent data is not as impressive, because exactly what's it doing to the cancer cell that's making the, you know, is it tagging it for sort of complement mediation destruction, or is it having some impact on intracellular signaling? It's hard to know at this point.
I'm going to guess the MAB, which stands for monoclonal antibody, and the name of the drug means it's not that toxic?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. There certainly are toxicities depending upon what you couple the drug with, because you will get binding of cells, and I think it depends upon what you hook it to. But yes, there have been certainly reported toxicities of certain anti-folic acid receptor drugs, so I think they're not totally non-toxic.
Yeah, it's true. I guess you get used to the fact that a lot of these antibodies, trastuzumab, rituximab, you know, are pretty non-toxic. But I guess it does depend on what you're targeting, too.
Correct. Exactly.
So folate could be more trouble than some of those other ones. Let's talk about your last patient, your 45-year-old lady.
45-year-old with high-grade serous cancer, diagnosed back in 2008 with stage 3C disease, is optimally cytoreduced, receives chemotherapy, platinum and paclitaxel, and then starts to have evidence of a recurrence about 2 years later. She starts to have an elevation of her CA125, and a CAT scan does show some diffuse peritoneal disease and some small amount of ascites. So I think in this patient, she's a different patient than the first one. She's certainly different than the second. She has platinum-sensitive recurrence. She's young. She's got a high-grade serous tumor, so she should certainly undergo BRCA testing. I think the question of whether or not to bring her to surgery always comes up. And I think the bottom line for that is if you think that you will benefit the patient by doing surgery, meaning that you're going to remove a mass that's large that may not get adequate chemotherapy to it, that's a possibility. If patients have an isolated node, an isolated periaortic node, those patients are excellent candidates for secondary cytoreductions. Tumor that's just indolent, that's just taken some time to grow. So that's a discussion that will come up. I think in this patient, she probably would not necessarily benefit from surgery because she has more diffuse peritoneal disease. The surgeon probably will not be able to take too much of that tumor out. And these patients, the reuse of platinum is the appropriate decision. And I think these patients have now options. Just like patients with newly diagnosed cancer also have options. The Calypso trial that was presented at ASCO last year, looking at carboplatinum Doxil versus carbopaclitaxel, there was an improvement in how women did with carbodoxil. So I think that's another great option. The use of bevacizumab, so the OCEANS trial that looks at carbogem plus or minus bevacizumab will tell us in a recurrent setting, in a platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, what is the benefit of adding Bev to these patients? And that data hasn't been presented yet, but will be presented very shortly. So these are patients that will traditionally go back into remission. They'll have about 50% response rates and typically will come out of remission with a shorter interval than the 2 years that she had initially.
So what did you do, or have you decided what you're going to do?
So she actually has gone on to our carbogem plus PARP inhibitor trial.
Interesting. Was she tested for BRCA?
She's in the process of getting tested right now.
And where is she right now in terms of the trials? She's been started on treatment?
She started on treatment. She's 3 cycles into it, had an excellent response, doing well in the chemotherapy, and CA5 is normalized pretty quickly after 2 cycles.
Of course, I guess you have no idea how much the PARP inhibitor is contributing. She might have responded just to the carbogem. This is a randomized study?
It's not. It's a straight phase 2.
Interesting.
She's tolerating the chemotherapy very well. One of the problems that we've seen, I know a lot of people have seen, is the risk of platinum allergies with the reuse of platinum. It's about a 25% overall risk. And I think it's important to remember that if patients do develop an allergy, that you work closely with an allergist who can do skin testing. You know, we've published a number of articles about a desensitization protocol that can be done anywhere. It can be done in the community setting, it can be done in an academic setting, that will allow patients to receive platinum. And especially in this patient, if she develops a platinum allergy, she's clearly benefiting from the drug. And this way, we could continue it out to 6 to 8 cycles.